Come, come, ye saints, no toil nor labor fear, but with joy wend your way.
To check out the video version of this episode, go to youtube.com/Mormon Stories. To keep these podcasts alive, please consider a financial contribution today at mormonstories.org, and thanks for listening.
So, what were the big breaks? Were there any big events that sort of propelled the Tanners into the spotlight? Because at some point you had to go from sort of mom and pop, you know, front of your house, salon, people just coming by to grab a pamphlet here, there. You went from that to a household name at some point. And what were there some events along the way that really sort of that launched you into the spotlight?
Well, that would be hard to say. I guess when we did our first Mormonism Shadow Reality in 64, that really, the church was aware of us before that. The Grand Richards had kind of threatened to sue us, sent us an intimidating letter.
Markey Peterson.
Markey Peterson had threatened us. Because
threatened you how?
With legal action because of what we were publishing.
What,
which they had no case, but they're just trying to... You have to understand the mindset of the 50s and early 60s. No one asked questions. This was like being a traitor to your country. No one asked questions. And so we're just these two young upstarts that didn't know the rules. And we're like, why can't I ask? Well, it's not respectful. And the church in those days controlled the community by the fear of excommunication. And so they were used to bullying people. When you got asked too many questions, you sent a letter to the editor, you did something too overt, then, brother, you're risking your membership. Well, that'd scare people to death. I'm going to lose my job. I won't have any life in the community if I lose my membership. So they controlled people by threatening lawsuits or excommunication to shut everyone down. Well, we were, what would you call, I don't remember the right word for it, but we didn't have to worry about a lawsuit. We had no assets. So what are you going to take? My old jalopy? Okay. So that was the thing the church was not used to, is someone not being afraid to stand up and challenge them on issues, always before they could intimidate you to make you back down.
Tell your story about writing Joseph Fielding Smith.
When we were still in California, and that was right after we got married early on, my mom and my aunt had got looking into some stuff on First Vision problems, and Gerald and me and them had all talked about First Vision problems. And my bishop, who's a real nice guy, he was trying to save the day and trying to pull me back into the church. And he said, Sandra, if you'll just write up your questions or get one question, I'll send it to Joseph Fielding Smith for you. Well, I have to back up. Okay, I got the story. Mm-hmm. That's a long time ago. So he said, if you get one question, I'll send it to Joseph Fielding Smith, who was an apostle and church historian. So we get in a big huddle. Okay, what's the
one question
that we want to send?
I've been there before.
So we're trying to think about, but we'd all been thinking and studying.
It's hard to come up with the one question,
well,
right?
Yeah. Well, and ours probably wasn't the most profound, but it was one that we were intrigued by, and that was the whole question of when did the First Vision become important, and when did they switch? Because we found that early on, they seemed to be talking about the First Vision in terms of an angel, and when did they switch it to Christ? So my mom and my aunt had both bought a copy of the historical record by Andrew Jensen, and he was church historian in the 1887 time period. In the historical record, he had printed in one issue the Joseph Smith First Vision story. And when he tells it, and this is about 1889 timeframe in this newspaper of his, Joseph goes in the woods to pray and an angel appears to him, and it says angel. Okay, my aunt wanted a copy of that book. So she went to some used bookstore to find a copy of the historical record. What she didn't know is she bought a reprint that was done a couple of years later, evidently after they started emphasizing the Jesus part of the first vision.
Oh, a different version of the book.
And so now the same book now reads, and he, the Christ, said to me.
Not God and instead, Jesus.
No, it's just the Christ. Instead of he, the angel, said to me. And so my mom and my aunt were like, what? How could, why were these changed at this point? So this was my question to Joseph Fielding Smith. Why did this historical record get changed from the angel to the Christ? It looks like there's a change in emphasis in the church at that point. In all our studies, we can't find early references to the first vision. We don't find Joseph Smith of Brigham Young saying Father and Son. Where does this develop into a doctrine of the Father and Son? It looks like early on it was something different. And
what about the 1838 account?
In Mormonism at that time, everyone was from a Protestant background. They would have just seen that as a spiritual experience, like Stephen seeing God, Christ on the right hand of God in vision. It would have been a vision thing. It wouldn't have told you anything about God the Father having a physical form.
Okay.
And that's all they would have made of it. Because Joseph, it's printed in 1842, so that's the first most of the Mormons ever heard about it. They would not have thought of it in terms of two separate beings because Joseph hadn't, he was just starting to teach that at that point. This develops from 42 to 44, Joseph's theology of separating God and Jesus. So anyone hearing the first vision before 42 would not have thought of it in anything other than a vision experience. It would have said nothing to about the nature of God in a physical form.
So even when Joseph gives the 1838 account where there's God, the Father, and the Son, You're thinking that in Joseph's mind, he's not thinking they're separate beings.
He might have, but no one hearing it would have.
Okay. All right.
And so we're asking Joseph Fielding Smith, so, okay, do you have a first, we want to know if there's a first account of the first vision in Joseph Smith's handwriting. Well, we didn't know that they're sitting on one, but we figured there ought to be one.
Because years prior, what had Joseph Fielding Smith stumbled on?
He had stumbled on that account and
the
had
1832
account and evidently ripped it out of the book.
It said what? Which said what?
That it's just Jesus. That he went out in the woods to know if his sins were forgiven, and because he already knew the churches weren't true, and he wanted to know if his sins were forgiven. And the Christ comes and tells him his sins are forgiven. So that Joseph Fielding Smith had hid that account, so he knew good and well what I'm writing about.
This is where Joseph had ripped it out.
Joseph Fielding Smith had taken those pages out of Joseph Smith's letter book and hid them away that had this strange account of the first vision that spoke only of Jesus in the first vision.
Right.
So I'm writing for a copy of the handwritten first vision.
After he's ripped this out, he knows that.
But I don't know that that has happened. I don't know anything about that. I just figured there ought to be a first vision in Joseph's handwriting.
Right.
So I want to see the original of this.
Right.
So that's my questions. And so my nice bishop, who's a real sweet guy, sends this off to Joseph Fielding, and Smith writes back and says, if this young woman would stop listening to the mouthings of the enemies of the church and seek for a testimony instead, and, you know, rags on me for a while. And then he says, and who was the angel? It was Moroni. And I'm reading this, Moroni? So it didn't make sense. So I said to the bishop called me into his office and let me read the letter in his office. He didn't send me home with a copy. I later badgered him to get a copy from him, what I have is a carbon copy of it. And the bishop says, yeah, I think that's fair. And I says, Bishop, he either didn't pay me the courtesy to go look at Andrew Jensen's history to even know what I'm talking about, Because if you have looked at it, you could see it isn't Moroni. Joseph says, going into the grove to pray. It's before the Book of Mormon story. And it can't be Moroni. So he didn't look up the reference, or else he's flat out misrepresenting things to me, knowingly misrepresenting. I said, either choice isn't real attractive here.
And how'd you feel about his language to you?
Oh, I was devastated. I thought, this is a man of God, and he's just going to castigate me for asking about the legitimate questions.
Yeah.
And instead, I get this call to repentance, and I think there's something in there about me being infatuated with my husband or something, listening to mouthings of enemies of the church. And I said, Bishop, you can't think that's fair. And he said, well, yeah, I think that's fair. And but he didn't know anything. He was a six-year convert into the church out of Seventh-day Adventist, I think. And real nice guy. But he didn't know anything about church history.
Yeah.
And I said, well, it isn't sufficient. And he had said, well, there's a guy in the ward that asks all these same kind of questions, and he came through it all. So if you want to meet with me on whatever date, I'll get Brother So-and-so to come, and you can talk to him, and he can answer all this stuff. I said, I'm willing to come here if someone's got the answers. I didn't think they did. I was pretty sure at this point that's not going to go anywhere, but I wanted to show the bishop that, hey, I'm open to truth. If you've really got the truth, I'm open to listening to it. So here's Brother So-and-so. Nice guy. And I started telling him, you know, we got blood atonement, we got Adam God, we got polygamy, we got all these different problems, changes in revelations and all this. And so he says, well, see, what you, I have those same questions, but what you need to do is to read Joseph Fielding Smith's Answers to Gospel Questions and Doctrines of Salvation. And I'm like, what? And I looked at the bishop and I said, Bishop, if you think Joseph Fielding Smith's books are the answer, you don't understand the questions. I'm past Joseph Fielding Smith. I've read the Journal of Discourse sermons that he's responding to. And I'm telling you that those aren't, that doesn't cover it. Like, the Adam God doctrine. He wants to just dismiss that as one sermon. And so he's got his little rationale for the one sermon in volume one, page 50 and 51 of the Journal of Discourses. And I said, Bishop, it isn't one page. That's not the only thing you got to reconcile.
Sure, sure. Okay, so Joseph Fielding Smith, you had that interaction. Later, as you're picking up steam with Gerald, Marky Peterson, and LeGrand Richards.
Yeah, of course, the LeGrand Richards letter came because of our meeting with him.
You met with LeGrand Richards.
Yeah.
He wrote A Marvelous Work in a Wonder, right?
Yeah.
And what was that meeting about?
Well, because of all this First Vision stuff, and my mom, although she didn't believe anything of Mormonism anymore, she did not want to see us leave the culture. So she was opposed to me leaving the church. It's okay not to believe it. A lot of us don't believe it. But you don't leave. And I said, Mom, it's not true. I would feel dishonest before God to stay supporting something that if I didn't really believe it. And so anyway, she's trying to save the day. So she writes to LeGrand Richards. Well, I don't remember how all this started. I sent a letter out to everyone I knew saying why I was leaving the church. And I sent a thing out saying there was a problem with the First Vision and that doesn't seem to be any way to reconcile this. And LeGrand Richards and had some, I don't remember now how the contact came with my mom, but I don't know if she pulled ranks by being a young or what, but she got us an appointment to go see LeGrand Richards.
He was an apostle.
An apostle, yeah. And you have to understand, back in 1960, there were only a million Mormons, and so it was not that hard to get in to see an apostle. Not like now that they got so many demands on their time. It's much harder to arrange that sort of stuff. But it wasn't in the 60s, except no one did. No one did for my reasons. You know, you don't ask questions. But my mom appealed to Richards to help us out, that we were struggling with these different things. And if he had an answer, it would be really good to share it with me. So he writes and says, oh, well, my great-grandpa personal buddy of Joseph Smith's, and Joseph told him his first vision story, said it was God and Jesus, and he went right home and wrote it in this journal. It's God and Jesus. And so I got absolute proof. You're all wet. You don't know what you're talking about. And so I'm writing back, well, I'd like to see that entry, because all I had researched so far told me he couldn't have a document like that. There wasn't that kind of use of the first vision in that time frame. So he says, well, we could come up to his office and he would show it to us. So we come up to the little gray church office building on South Temple and go into his very nice walnut-lined office. And so he's there in his big desk. It's like going into a, you know, big bank CEO. I mean, it was a very nice office. So anyways, he has this page of extracts from his great-grandpa's journal. And so he says, here's the quote. And Gerald reads this and he says, well, I was expecting to see the document. This just, you've just got typed excerpts here. And you just got two lines or whatever sentences here on this first vision thing. I wanted to see the context, see where it's setting. And Richard's got real miffed that I've gone to all this trouble and you kids are just troublemakers, you know? It was a crazy, I don't know how much, do you want to know how bad this got?
Yeah. I mean, I just, what it was like.
So LeGrand starts questioning us about, well, why are we asking these kind of questions? Where are we at in our life? And, you know, are we really looking for the truth in that? And so Gerald's telling him, he says, well, I was a inactive Mormon boy. I struggled with drinking and smoking and crowding around. And then I went back to Missouri and I met these people and I gave my heart to Christ and all that stuff went away. I don't smoke or drink anymore and God's touched my life. And we just want to tell the Mormon people about Jesus and about the love of God. And Richard's response to this was, I never smoked. And we're like, what? And I'm sitting there thinking, an apostle of Jesus Christ, here's Gerald in this humble, sincere way telling him of how God had touched his life. And LeGrand, all he could think to say is, I never smoked. You know, okay. And then they talked a little more about the love of God and, you know, what do you got to offer kind of thing? And LeGrand says, well, just what do you think you have to offer to the Mormon people? And Gerald says, forgiveness through Christ, the love of God. Well, if you think you've got more love than us, you're crazy. Oh, that helped. Back to the first vision. Can we see the document? And he says, he's huffing about it. Well, we'd have to go over to the genealogical library. And I said, well, we got the time. Well, this is before they built the 28-story office building. And the old genealogical building was through the block where the west wing of the big office building is now. So the elevator's a real trip. We get on the elevator, and there's these two middle-aged ladies on the elevator. And I thought they were going to pass out. Oh, Mabel, it's an apostle of Jesus Christ. And she was just, they were just so enamored of this experience. And I'm thinking, wow, if you'd have been in his office 20 minutes ago, I don't know that you'd have it quite that same attitude. Well, we get over to the genealogical library and we have to go up in the elevator to get to the floor. And obviously apostles never could win in there because we walked in and everybody quit talking. Oh, it's an apostle. You could hear it just, you know, go around the room. It's an apostle. And so we're the center of attention. So he goes over to card catalog, looks up his grandpa's diary, gets the call number, gives it to the girl at the desk. She goes and gets the microfilm, brings it out, puts it on the reader, and he whips it over. He knew right where he's going. He whips it over to the part he wanted, and he says, there it is. And so Gerald can see the whole page. And Gerald reads it, and he says, well, it sounds like Joseph Smith's dead. This sounds all past tense. I want to turn it, can I turn it back earlier to see what the time period of this is? Because he had told us it was, you know, like that night his great-grandpa went home and wrote this in his diary. And he said, I want to turn it back and see what the date is on this. And Richards got real miffed, and he just whipped that machine and got that off of the reader. And he says, I brought you all the way from the office building over this to show you this, and you still aren't satisfied. You aren't really seeking for truth. You just want to make trouble. And he takes the reel, hands it to the girl, and he says, if they come back, you don't show it to them. They're just troublemakers. Mm. And he turns to walk out, and Gerald's right behind him. Why can't I see it? What are you hiding? If you really got what you said, you would let me turn the reel back to the page before. And I'm trying to sneak out behind him. I was so embarrassed because everybody was watching this. And, well, I went back a few days later to try and check it out because I had the call number. And they said, oh, it's out for repairs. I said, really? It was okay a few days ago. Well, things break. And then I went back later and tried another time. Oh, no, it's still out. Huh. So months later, I finally go in, and I had kept the call number in my purse in case I ever got uptown again to go look it up. So I go in, and I go up to the desk, and I turn the call number into the fill the slip out. The girl goes to the back. Pretty soon she comes back, and she says, how did you have that number? And I said, oh, well, I was here a few months ago and looked at it, and I didn't finish my research, and so I wanted to check something and look again at it to verify some dates. Oh, you already saw it. Yeah, I saw it a few months ago. Oh, well, how did you have the number? And I said, well, I've written it down. And she says, well, yeah, I wondered about that because we'd taken that card out of the card catalog. But since I'd seen it before, I must be authorized.
Uh-oh.
So she goes and gets it and puts it on the microfilm reeler, and I reel it over. And, oh, yes, the guy's memoirs out here in Utah, like in the 1880s. So, yeah, at that point, he's saying it's God and Jesus, because that's when the church has started to emphasize it. So it proved nothing for what we were talking about, that early on they weren't saying it was the Father and Son. So we printed up extracts of this, and then LeGrand Richard sent us a threatening letter to sue us because we didn't have permission from him to publish part of his great-great-grandpa's journal. And, you know, hey, you print part of my great-great-grandpa's journal. You didn't ask me. I mean, who gets to say on these family deals? Who gets to print what? No one asked me for the young, all my aunts and uncles. They never got asked about anything I'm printing. Diaries of Brigham Young or anything.
Right.
So anyway, so that was LeGrand Richards.
And this first vision story is important because the Book of Mormon claims that Joseph and Jesus are one. True? The God, the Father,
Book of Mormon,
and Jesus
yeah.
are one.
Mm-hmm.
And then Joseph's original account of the first vision has who appearing to him?
His original account just has Jesus.
The Lord, right?
The Lord.
Okay. And then the lectures on faith, what do they say about God and Jesus?
That God is a personage of spirit, while the Son is a personage of tabernacle. It makes that very distinct difference, spirit and tabernacle. And the Father and Son are one God, and the Holy Ghost is the mind of the two.
Right.
So and that was Mormonism of 1835. You would have just believed in one God. It would have sounded very Protestant.
Yeah, and this idea of God and Jesus being distinct beings comes much later.
Right.
As
not
things
until
evolve.
After 38.
And so why, I guess one big problem, whether it's with the Whitmer letter or with the first vision account or with Joseph's theology, why is it changing? Or the Doctrine of Covenants and Book of Commandments. And that's kind of a central problem.
Well, at the
for
beginning, yeah, but at the beginning of Mormonism, he's just talking about an angel telling him about the Book of Mormon and these plates hidden in the woods. And I'm assuming most of these people would have come out of the revival background. Most of the early Mormons were Methodists, and they would have been used to conversion stories. So, what's Joseph's conversion story? You mean just wham, some night an angel shows up and tells you about the plates? How did you get forgiveness of your sins or whatever? I think he started to realize he needed a better start to the story. Now, he may have gone in the woods as a teenager and had some sort of religious experience that he now is drawing on, but that was not a part of his idea of his call when he starts talking about the Book of Mormon. That there's nobody knows of any experience before the angel and the Book of Mormon plates.
So there's no evidence that he ever told anyone of a First Vision account until 1832.
Well, he didn't tell anyone that one. He just wrote it in his personal papers. We don't know that he told it to anyone until 35, when he has some guys visit him in Kirtland, and he says that angels appeared to him.
Right. How do you think he came up with the Book of Mormon?
I think he was fascinated by the American Indian. His mom says that he entertained the family at night with stories of the American Indian. I think that's when he's rehearsing his book. I think he was influenced by View of the Hebrews. I don't know if he read it, but I think he had read it or read stuff. It was in the papers about speculating of who are the American Indians. Are they descended from Israel? One of the atheist arguments was to the Christians, looks like your God lost a whole continent. How come he didn't send any witness to these guys? You know? Oh, well, the Christians start thinking about that. Well, he must have done. And so maybe the early people here were Israelites that came over, and so they weren't forgotten people. God had been working on them. And so you had dozens of books at the time speculating the American Indians were the lost tribes of Israel, or part of the lost tribes, and that they had the law, that they had the Word of God, at least in the Old Testament form. And so a lot of people read into Indian legends similarities to Christianity that I don't believe were really there, but they were looking for a justification that God didn't overlook a continent and that there had been some kind of a witness there. Joseph Smith's family was divided on religion. His grandpa was enamored of Thomas Paine, and the father was a universalist, and the mother and sister and a couple of brothers went into the Presbyterians. Joseph favored the Methodists. I don't know what all kind of discussions happened in the home, but I don't think this was a happy home. I think there were a lot of problems there on arguments over religion, arguments over life. I think the father had a drinking problem. I'm sure that must have caused problems. Alvin, the oldest brother, was evidently the mainstay of the family, kept things organized. Then he dies tragically. Throws the family into confusion, and the father evidently isn't strong enough to come in and pull things together. He makes bad business decisions and all. So I think Joseph capitalizes on his imagination, his storytelling, all these things he's heard and imagined about the American Indian to pull them together to make a book. And I think he originally thought he was going to make money on this to help the family come out of poverty. The Book of Mormon has a lot of revival rhetoric in it. I think King Benjamin probably was one of the Methodist revival preachers in the area. I think what you see of that type of thing in the Book of Mormon are echoes of the revival meetings he went to. That's why those like me, when we still believed the Book of Mormon, saw Christ there, because there was this echo of preaching from his area that comes through the Book of Mormon, through Joseph, to where we're hearing some of those sermons there. And we're getting all kinds of verses from the Bible. I mean, the Book of Mormon is just chock full of phrases out of the Bible. And so it sounds biblical. I don't know how religious the original Book of Mormon intent was, because it seems to take a stronger bent to religion when he loses 116 pages.
Do you think he wrote the original manuscript with somebody else?
I don't buy the Spalding theory, if you're getting to that.
No, I'm just Oliver Cowdery, Sidney Rigdon.
I don't think Rigdon had a part in it at all. And one of the reasons I say that, and well, there are a lot of reasons, but Rigdon has a specific influence on Mormonism when he comes into it. If he had been there from the start, I don't think you would see that shift when he joins, if he's the original architect. And the fact that it does change when he comes in, that he does have an influence on Joseph's view of the Old Testament. The Book of Mormon moves New Testament into the Old Testament. Rigdon seems to move the Old Testament into the New Testament.
So Rigdon's a restorationist.
Yeah.
Wanting to bring back everything.
Yeah.
Joseph Smith saying, they were baptizing for Jesus back in 400 BC, right?
Yeah, right. Well, he's a restorationist too, only he thinks he's restoring what every generation had, that they always had this knowledge of Christ. But the Book of Mormon...
So was the Book of Mormon inconsistent with Rigdon's teachings?
No, it echoed a lot of the Campbellite restoration movement, opposed to the idea of creeds and professional clergy. The Book of Mormon model is much more of a folksy, God calls you, and you can be the captain of the army, but God calls you to also be his spiritual leader to the people in that. So the Book of Mormon seems to have a much looser church structure. I think by the end of the Book of Mormon, Joseph is envisioning now starting a church. And so he tacks on Moroni because it seems so out of place. You're going through this history, then you get the Book of Ether, and then bam, suddenly you get Moroni. He's all concerned with what the sacrament prayer is going to be, what the baptismal prayer is going to be. I mean, the guy's already told us he's out of plates and he doesn't have much to say. Which I think is pretty funny when you think about it. You got to hand make these. You're on the run from those bad Lamanites are trying to kill you off. And he's going to stick on the Book of Moroni? You go back and you read it, and it's just all this church particulars that seem strange, out of place. And I think that's when he's decided he's going to start a church. So I think it all is Joseph Smith. Cowdery could have helped him. His family could have helped him. His mother could have helped him. But it has to be someone on the scene. I think it has to be someone in the group that's around him at that time. But the Book of Mormon is Joseph's baby. Nephi is Joseph Smith's alter ego. Here's the younger son, favorite of God.
But that was all written after the pages were lost, right?
Yeah, but I think there probably was... I think that same storyline had to be there, but in a less religious format. But I suspect the same story was there because Martin and these different people had read the 116 pages, so they would have been familiar already who the lead characters were. So I think the lead characters have had to stay the same. But he can't remember what he had everybody doing, so he's got to have Nephi come up with this very strange idea that, I don't know why, but God told me to make a second set of plates with the religious parts, and it's all in God's knowledge, and so he makes a separate set. Okay, so the first
part. So the first, the 116 pages were more secular.
Yes,
maybe
I think
so. About wars and that kind of thing.
Settling the land or whatever. Yeah, I don't think it had as much a religious tone, because it obviously didn't, because he tells us that this other set's going to be more spiritual. So obviously the other set wasn't.
Right, right.
So what do we get in the spiritual stuff? They already brought the brass plates with them that had the Book of Isaiah on it. And he's going to laboriously etch into these homemade plates chapter after chapter of Isaiah that they already got on brass plates. I mean, I don't get this, but it's filler. He lost 116 pages. He's got to impress Martin Harris that he is duplicating that much of the manuscript. So you get all kind of filler. So that's when...
So it's Joseph Sr.'s dream becomes Lehi's dream.
Yeah. And the books of Isaiah.
Oh, Isaiah, 2 Nephi is just filler.
Yeah. It's just, he's trying to get... So once he figures he got a high enough stack of paper, then we hit this crazy stuff about I'm Enos or whoever it is, and I'm a bad guy, I don't have much to say, so I'm giving it to my son. I'm another bad guy, and we had some wars, and I don't have much to say, and I'm giving it to my son. I mean, it's a ridiculous transition. But, see, because you go through 1st, 2nd, Nephi, and Jacob, and you haven't moved the timeline more than 30 years or something.
Right.
And bam, suddenly we're going hundreds of years to get up to Messiah.
Which is where the original manuscript would have taken off?
Right.
Okay.
Now, isn't that convenient? I mean, talk about the wisdom of God. Evidently...
You're saying God's not a good editor? Is that what you're saying?
No, that he made this great plan, hundreds of years ago that Nephi was going to do all this history for all these years, condense it down to get these pages, and then God's going to tell him, boy, you got to make a spiritual part. Okay, so does he stick it right after that first part, or is it a separate set of plates? Because this becomes a problem. If you have it right after those pages, he would have seen those. And that's why the Mormons talk about it now. They want to talk like the stack had Nephi stuck in there. I mean, what are you going to do with the first part that it replaces? Was that a separate set of plates? Or was it on the stack with the small plates stuck in the middle? Isn't it wonderful that Nephi stops his spiritual set exactly where the break is to start off with Mosiah? I mean, it's all very convenient, which says to me it's an invention after the fact because he's afraid Mrs. Harris still has the 116 pages and she's waiting for her chance to prove to Martin this guy's a con. He can't give you the same words again. So he's hedging his bets. She may still have those plates. She's kind of a tricky person. So I better...
Smart.
Yeah, I got to come up with some way in which I can tell them why it's not the same words again, and yet have a believable excuse. I don't think Martin's the swiftest guy on the block. I mean, when I first read that, one of the problems I had with Martin in believing the Book of Mormon was it just seemed, I mean, this is the best witness we can get. Here's the guy sitting on a fence, picking his teeth, and Joseph comes up to him just then. Martin drops the pick in the sawdust or whatever down his feed straw. And he says to Joseph, you got your seer stone on you? Yeah, why? Well, I just dropped my pen. I want to see if you can find it. So Joseph gets it down, and Martin says he never looked to the left or the right. He just reached right down there and picked up his pen and handed it to him. So he knew he had the gift. And the other great...
Martin writes this story?
Yeah. Huh. And another one, interview. Another one of his interviews, he tells about how, we were translating, and one day, midday, we got tired and tried to break, and so we went down to the river, and so he's thinking he's going to test Joseph. So he finds a rock that he brings back and switches in Joseph's hat to see if this guy really has discernment. And Joseph comes back, he picks up his hat, and he says, Martin, who has put it in your heart to test the Lord? Some words to that effect. And it's, oh, so now Martin's sure that, yeah, well, gee, see, he really is a prophet of God. He discerned that right off. Joseph's been staring at this rock for 4 years. What would be the chances of walking to a riverbed and finding a stone so unusual that Joseph saved it in the first place? Because it was so unusual that it had magic powers, that Martin would find another one that casually to come back and stick in the hat. Of course, Joseph would immediately see it wasn't his stone. But to Martin, that's a big proof. And so when I'm first reading these stories, I'm thinking, gee, I want to believe this, but this it sounds very childish. You know, it's not very discerning.
Yeah.
What kind of a test is this?
Right. Okay, so you think Joseph wrote the book,
yeah.
Maybe with help.
Yeah.
We talked about Marky Peterson and LeGrand Richards threatening you guys with lawsuits. You talked about how Gerald's book was kind of a big first launch.
Yeah.
I've got a laundry list of items that I know you've been involved in. Mm-hmm. Before I launch into them, are there any other chronological sort of events that you were a part of that you feel like were really significant in taking you guys to increasing levels of notoriety and significance?
Well, in 67, the rumor was going around that some of the papyri still existed. And it was rumored that... For the Book of Abraham, and that Nibley might know something about it. Well, there's no way I'm asking Nibley. I mean, he's not going to talk to me about anything.
And he hates you by this point.
Yes, evidently, yes. So we started beating the bushes to anybody we knew that might know anything. You know anything about these supposed remnants still of Joseph's collection on Egyptian? And nobody knew anything. Everyone had heard some rumors that, yeah, there might be something out there. And then finally, an acquaintance of ours that was at the University of Illinois wrote to us and sent us a series of call numbers. And he says, I've just talked with Klaus Baer, who was the Egyptologist at the, Oriental Institute at the University of Chicago. And in fact, I think he taught Nibley a couple of classes in Egyptian. Anyways, this fellow, the friend of ours that was a professor, had met with Klaus Baer because he was also interested, this fellow was interested in Mormon history. Never been Mormon, but he was interested in it. And he'd gone and talked to Klaus Baer, and Klaus Baer had said, oh, I've got something to show you. And he got out some Polaroids or something of the Book of Abraham papyri and shows this guy, well, I guess they must have been prints, and he shows this guy these prints of pieces of the facsimile number one that we now know about and some of the different pieces of papyri. And this guy looks on the back and it has call numbers. Well, this fellow, Baer told him he couldn't tell anyone about this, but he memorized the call numbers, which I find absolutely astounding. I can't remember phone numbers for zip, you know, and he's memorizing these call numbers. And so he comes back outside and he writes them down. And he writes and tells us, if you can find the library that has these type of call numbers, you'll find the Joseph Smith collection of the papyri. Wow. Well, where do you start on that? He can't tell us what library they're in. That's as much of a clue he can give us. Here's the call numbers.
Huh.
So, us and Wes Walters and Mike Marquardt and a guy named Grant Heward and everybody we knew was all beating the bushes trying to figure out what those numbers would relate to. Are they a university? Are they a museum? What kind of a collection? What are we looking for? We went up to the University of Utah and talked to Dr. Atiyah, who was the head of the Oriental Studies at the university at the time. He was a Coptic Christian from Egypt. And, well, we didn't know he was working with the church to acquire these documents from the Metropolitan Museum. And we go up and show him the call numbers. We're trying to figure out what university or museum or whatever this goes to. We figured, oh, there's a good guy to ask. You know, he probably know these numbers and recognize what school would this be. And Dr. Atiyah throws us off the mark and he says, oh, well, I understand Brown University has a big Egyptian collection.
And he knows.
Well, yeah, he's working with the church to get them to acquire these documents. And he throws us off on the call numbers. And so I don't remember who was the one that finally wrote to the Metropolitan. It might have been Wes Walters, but somebody finally wrote to the Metropolitan and asked them, do you recognize these numbers? And the curator there writes back, it's funny you should ask me about that because we just turned those over to the Mormon church. Really?
You think the church paid for them? Or?
Oh, no, the church doesn't pay for things. They had a mission president make an anonymous donation of a couple of ancient statues. So we missed it. However, so then the church makes an announcement about acquiring the papyri. And I think it's in a December, what year would that have been? 67, 68. Anyways, they make this announcement that they got these papyri. But I don't think they were planning on printing photographs right away. But a friend of ours, through his connections, had got some Polaroids of the pieces from the Metropolitan Museum. I don't remember just now how he got his copies, but they were poor, just Polaroid photos of the documents. And so he went to the Deseret News with his photographs, and he says, are you guys going to print good quality photographs? Because, see, I have these, but they aren't good. So I wonder if you guys are going to put out some good ones. okay, this puts the church on notice that photographs are out there. You can't sit on this, guys. Somebody's already unzipped the pillow and the feathers are coming out. So they do a rush job on the February enzyme. And so if you look at the February, what would it be, 68 enzyme, they have the photos of the papyri are inserted in the middle of the magazine, and it's obviously an afterthought because the page numbers don't go right. And they go like four to page 40, and then it's 40A, 40B, 40C, you know. I mean, it's this odd numbering in the middle that tells you they hadn't planned on this insert. And it's just shoved in there in the middle so they can get the photos out first to lay claim to them, I guess, to the pictures or whatever. And so that's how you, and if you go look up that, it's not Ensign, it's the Improvement Era. You go look up that issue of the Improvement Era, you can see it was a rush job to put the photos in. Why? What was the rush? Well, the Tanners have got friends that got photographs. They may not be good, but we got them. So they rushed that into print. So we were right on the ground floor on the Book of Abraham. Well, earlier than that, we had already done the reprint of Why Egyptologists Reject the Book of Abraham with the Reverend Spalding's work in 1912 on the facsimiles. And we'd already printed a photo reprint of that 1912 stuff.
So in the early 1900s, some Egyptologists were able to see the...
No, they were going on the pictures in the Pearl of Great Price.
And they saw them and said,
no, these are all just, this Osiris, this Anubis, this is Isis, this is nothing to do with Abraham, guys, sorry. You know.
And didn't this make it into the New York Times? Like, it was kind of a big deal.
Yeah, the New York Times had a big fold-out, museum walls. How did it state it? Anyways, exposed the fraud. And it was, you know, flamboyant heading.
Yeah.
Tanner style. So, and you can see that on our website. But anyway, so there was stuff in 1912 challenging the Book of Abraham at that time. And the church was able to quiet that down and to move on. And people kind of forgot about the Book of Abraham issue. Except we had found out about the alphabet and grammar and had actually published... a copy of the Egyptian, Joseph Smith's Egyptian Alphabet and Grammar before they found the papyri. We were already doing stuff on the Book of Abraham. And so there was a lot of talk in the mid-60s about Book of Abraham stuff. And then the papyri come out. And then Nibley goes on for 2 years, I think, in the Ensign with Abraham in Egypt, where he's spinning all sorts of stuff about Abraham never dealing directly with the issue of really explaining what the problem is on the translation, but trying to make us all feel at ease. Everything's okay, guys. I got it under control. Church is true. Don't worry about the Book of Abraham.
I'm smart. Just take my word for it.
Yeah, we'll just slide that under the counter here.
sleight of hand, like you said.
Yeah, right. So that was one of the big things of the 60s was the Book of Abraham issue.
Okay.
And I feel like we forced their hand on that.
Okay. What other kind of the bigger things? And then I'll list a bunch of little ones so we can talk about them. And you know, I just want to know what comes to your mind as your proudest achievements, basically.
Well, I guess that would be the Mark Hoffman case.
Okay, let's talk about that. Tell us a bit about Mark Hoffman.
Mark Hoffman was a young Mormon kid that evidently in his teen years quit believing Mormonism, but went on a mission because his family was uber Mormon and he felt he had to go. He went to England and...
You think he lost his faith before his mission?
Oh, yeah.
Do you have any evidence or data?
There's a story about him as a young teen. He had got in a fire or something and was bedridden for a while. And so while he's recuperating from this burn... he was reading on coins and collecting coins, and he read about that there was a certain kind of dime from a certain year that would have a great value if it had a certain mint mark on it. And so he evidently forged a mint mark onto a dime of that time period sent it to the Mint, to the Federal Mint, to have it authenticated. And evidently they wrote back and said, yeah, you got a real deal here. And he evidently gave up belief in God at that point, that there is no God. I can fool anybody. And I think that, I don't know what he did in the meantime, but when it got time for his mission, I think that he went for his family and not because he believed it. And he gets to England and he's buying up all kind of old Mormon books that he thinks will have value to ship back here to book dealers to pay for his mission, pay for his extras. I'm not sure what all he did with the money, but he had already started to develop a reputation as a document dealer, book dealer, on his mission. He comes back and he's going to Weber, I believe, and he gets hold of Mormonism Shadow Reality.
Your book.
Yeah. We're responsible. And I don't know what all else he would have read besides us, but I know he had that. And loses his faith. Well, I think he already had lost all his faith. But anyways, it got him into Mormon history more. I think that launched him on the idea of how to do a sting on the church.
He was trying to hurt the church.
Yes.
Just like, I mean, I don't know. Do you feel like you and Gerald were trying to hurt the church?
No, we weren't trying to make a sting on him. We just wanted to get the real story out there. We thought the real story was bad enough.
But hurting the church was kind of the goal, right?
Well, the hurting,
weakening, undermining,
well,
exposing.
Exposing what we felt was a false religion that was leading people astray spiritually.
And Hoffman was...
Hoffman doesn't have that goal. He's just mad and wants to get back at him.
Okay. So you think that's fueling him?
Our book helped to fuel him, but I think it's the anger, yeah, of wanting to get back at the church.
For being fooled or misled or...
Well, for all the trouble he'd had as a kid with his fanatic Mormon home, and his family had secrets he found out later about it. He had had grandpa or something that had practiced polygamy after the manifesto, and it was a big family secret. And he starts finding out all this kind of stuff, and he's just mad at the church for all this that's been imposed on his family and on him, from pressure from a church that isn't really true. We find out later his dad's really fanatic, because when after Mark commits the murders, his dad wants him to plead guilty and not have a trial, so he'll get shot at the prison and get blood atoned and be forgiven. So, I mean, that's how strong his dad was a believer. Anyways, Mark starts studying Mormon history, and he decides, well, you could make, you know, he'd already been doing books that make money. You could make more money if you found documents that no one had before. So he starts trying to think of different things that could have been that weren't embarrassing to the church, you know, someone's letter to somebody, different things that were innocuous in a way, or maybe helped the church a little bit. And you start building up your reputation. And then we start hearing rumors that there is this odd letter from Martin Harris that people refer to as the Salamander letter that has Martin writing to this guy about the coming out of the Book of Mormon, telling it in terms of a magic story, of a magical setting of his money-digging days, of the salamander that jumps out of the hole and transforms himself and attacks him and stuff. And so it's this odd story. Well, that'd be worth some money, you know, because the church would want it off the street. So we start getting rumors about the Salamander letter, but no one's got a copy. Well, we know now Mark is the one spreading the rumors. All of Mark's documents, when we'd hear rumors about them ahead of time, that was Mark. He was deliberately putting out feelers by starting the Mormon research committees talking about this. It gave value to his documents. Ah, something's afield. And we're all excited about, you know, what's going to come out next. It was a real exciting time in Mormon history.
80s, right?
In the 80s.
Early 80s?
Early 80s. Yeah. And so then we get wind of the Salamander letter, and Gerald kept shaking the tree to try to see if someone would come loose with a copy. You know, I got to see the wording because everyone had reports. Well, it says this or says that. Well, no, I got to see the wording. I got to see the what it actually says. He finally gets a copy of the text. And he's so excited because he thinks, wow, this is going to be the, you know, the real blow to Mormonism. And he starts looking at it, reading through it. And he comes to me and he says, I don't think this is real. I'm like, what? Everybody believes it's real. How? What do you mean? You don't think it's real? And I think by then they'd even had some ink testing and stuff done on it, and everything was checking out. And so Gerald and I would have these conversations about, which do you think is more improbable? That a guy between 20 and 25 could find every major document on Mormon history, or that a guy between 20 and 25 could invent all these major documents of Mormon history? Either position is unreasonable. So, which one is it? Well, my position was, well, you got Dean Jesse up there, you got all these trained historians and all, they aren't going to want to jump on the bandwagon of this stuff unless it's really true. So they're having it examined and all, and they're convinced that it's authentic. So how would you think that you're in a position to be more knowledgeable? And Gerald says, I'm telling you, it isn't true. Well, how do you know it isn't true? He says, because the wording is dependent on E.D. Howe's Mormonism Unveiled and an article that had come out a year or two before this, I don't remember the dates, on Joseph Knight, I think it was. And there was stuff in Joseph Knight letters in that article about Martin Harris stuff. And he says, there's wording from the Knight article, the Knight documents that they're talking about here, there's wording from that and E.D. Howe's stuff, and it's in this Martin Harris letter. And I said, well, yeah, but if you have these different people recording, saying that Martin had told them this stuff, then couldn't it be possible that they're all just relating the same thing? Because that's the way Martin told the story. So how would you know which came first? And he's, I'm telling you, this is a product of those documents. It's reverse borrowing. Someone's looked at these to come up with this. He had done the same thing earlier on the Cowdery defense, which we didn't even talk about. That's another early document that Gerald questioned. Fawn Brody had used it in her book, and Gerald says, I don't think the Cowdery defense is authentic. Supposed to be a document Oliver Cowdery made later in his life in, 47, or I don't remember the years anymore. No, it's, what's the date on that? 39, maybe? That he was supposed to have printed this article about why he left Mormonism. And Gerald says, you know, he didn't believe the Cowdery defense, and he started looking into all that and found reasons why he didn't think it was historical. Gerald had some...
Was that a Hoffman forgery too?
No, this is before Hoffman.
Okay.
No, totally different. No, it had to have been made up sometime in 1900.
Okay.
For whatever reasons. And Gerald had a sixth sense for spotting those kind of patterns. Gerald was kind of like being around Sherlock Holmes or House or... you know, the different detective stories like that you'd see on TV these days, of where someone walks in a room and they see something out of place. And it doesn't matter what anything else is. This is that. Why is the pencil sharpener moved? There has to be a reason that was moved. And so that was Gerald. I mean, he would look at these documents and he would pick up on the anomaly. And he was right. And I was mad at him for some time.
Because you wanted it to be true.
I wanted it to be true.
Confirmation bias,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, right. Yeah. I said, Gerald, are you sure? Well, okay. So a year before the murder, Mark's murders, Gerald gets up his little paper explaining why he thinks it came from this other document and prints up this little flyer thing and wants me to take it to Sunstone and pass it out at Sunstone challenging Mark's documents. I said, Gerald, we're going to lose our house. That guy's going to sue us. This is slander. Well, we didn't directly name, you know, say that just the document isn't authentic. And Gerald says, he's not going to sue us. because it's a fake document. I said, well, please don't lose my house. And he says he's not going to sue. He has no provenance. There's nothing to prove this document. Okay. So I go up to Sunstone, and I'm passing out these flyers to everyone. The buzz is going around, you know, man bites dog. This is not the story you're expecting. Why would Gerald attack this document that would help his case to show that Joseph was involved in magic at the start of Mormonism? So it would be, you would expect him to be on the bandwagon to say it's authentic. And he's not. He's saying, no, there's something wrong here, guys. Well, the historians are all thinking, well, Gerald Tanner, who could trust him? You know, he's just gadfly. He doesn't know zip. And we've had it tested, so we know it's authentic. And then, so they weren't paying attention to us. Well, Monday, I get a visit from Mark Hoffman.
Whoa.
And he comes in. Sandra.
Have you met him before?
Oh, yeah. He'd been in the store before.
What was he like? Did you like him?
Well, I don't know. He was just kind of a quiet, mousy sort of guy. I don't know. You would not have thought of him as this clever, deceiving fellow behind the scenes making up this big conspiracy to do in the church. You know, I mean, one of the reasons he got away with a lot of stuff is he was so nondescript that people didn't remember seeing him. So when they were trying to investigate all the different aspects of what led up to the murders, his forgeries, where he bought supplies, they would go in and ask people, do you remember the guy that bought this stuff? No, medium high, just, you know, nobody could find a description because he didn't impress you. And that was his genius in that sense, that no one thought of him as clever enough, sneaky enough. He didn't give off this aura of great creativity, you know.
What about of being a genius?
No, you just saw him an average guy.
Really?
Yeah.
But he wasn't, right?
Well, he knew church history. He could sit and talk with you about problems in church history. But, I mean, I talked to a lot of people about church history.
Did you get a sense that he had a testimony?
Oh, no. No, I knew he didn't.
Okay.
I knew when he was dealing documents with the church and they were all talking about him being a Mormon, I knew he didn't believe it. Not that he told me. There's a certain tone, there's a certain manner in which you discuss things when you don't believe than when you do. And when someone comes in and gleefully wants to talk about something about Joseph Smith's money digging, this is not a believer. You know, so it's that kind of thing. The things that he wanted to talk about were embarrassing topics to a believing Mormon. So I knew he didn't believe it. I never challenged him on his double standard that obviously he was portraying to the church he was a real believer when obviously he didn't. I talk to people like that all the time. I mean, that was part of my job, was to talk to people that are living a double life.
Okay.
So
not some scary evil genius by appearance.
No. So here's this average
sort of
guy.
So he comes and knocks on your door.
Sandra, how could you question my documents? You guys, of all people, I thought would be in my corner on this. And then he starts giving this big sales pitch about, you guys are going to really hurt my investigations here because I'm in touch with this descendant of the Thomas Bullock family, and Bullock had been a secretary at Brigham Young. See, now he's playing into my connection to Brigham Young. See, so he knows how to work you. And he's like, yeah, I got this Thomas Bullock descendant that has all the Thomas Bullock papers, and he's got all this financial data that shows how Brigham was ripping off the church, and he's using church funds for everything and not paying back his loans. And I got, you know, so he's giving me this big sales pitch, all this stuff he's going to get from the Bullock family, but I'll scare him off if I start talking about the documents or forgeries or Mark doesn't believe or whatever, you know. So he's appealing to me, don't foul up my Bullock transaction by making waves over here. It would be to your best interest for me to go through with this transaction on Bullock. Right, so I'm taking all this in. And Mark leaves, and Gerald came home from wherever he had been. And he came in, and I said, oh, yeah, you missed Mark Hoffman here. Let me tell you about... So I started telling him all about this Bullock collection and all this stuff. And Mark says, you know, we're going to hurt him getting this. And I'm giving him my big sales pitch that I got from Mark. And Gerald's just listening to all this, and he says, yeah, and I got a bridge in Brooklyn I want to sell you. And I said, really? And he says, he's putting you on.
I said, wow.
How can you know that? He says, I'm telling you, he's making these things up. Well, we'd already been discussing which is more probable, that you'd make him up or find him. He says, he's making him up. He hasn't even committed the murders yet.
So Gerald has the spirit of discernment.
Oh, yeah.
But other people don't.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes, it was very maddening because I wanted Mark's documents to be true. We even did a split editorial in the newspaper, and the Mormons later ragged on us for that, saying, oh, you guys are just playing both sides of the fence to be safe. You're going to talk both ways. And I'm thinking, wow, if you'd have been in my kitchen, you know, this was not some collaboration on some way to play it safe. I mean, we had serious discussions about this. And so the only way I was going to let him put in his stuff on, against all of that, is if I have a chance to say something to the other side. Well, we don't know all the facts, and there are these things to consider, and the church says they've done all these tests, and, you know, so I've got my stuff over here. Gerald's got his. So when the first bomb goes off, and they're, at first the police are talking about that with Steve Christensen, the guy that Mark blew up, his business kind of partner, buddy.
This is Mr. Mack's son, right?
Yes, and we all thought that Mack and Steve Christensen were buds. So you wouldn't think Mark would kill him. And so the thought was, well, Steve... Well, then, in just a few hours later, you had the bomb go off at the, can't remember the other guy's name.
Policeman.
No, the financial guy over on in Murray somewhere. Why can't I can't remember the name? Sheets. Mr. Sheets. A bomb goes off at his house, killing the wife. And so then the speculation is, okay, it has to do with a failed business that Mr. Sheets and Steve Christensen have been involved in. And so it must be that. Maybe it's the mafia or something, that these guys were in some sort of bad business deal. And, of course, the police are suspicious of all that because that is not the way the mafia necessarily would do with the bombs and the way they'd go about that. But anyways, the case is trying to look at business transactions of these two guys, which deflects it from Mormon document dealing.
Why was he bombing people, in your view?
He had rung up so much debt. Well, he had invented, he'd branched out from Mormonism. He had invented a copy of the Oath of a Free Man, the earliest document of America. And there's only like one or two in existence. And he made one up and was trying to sell it to Library of Congress. And they were dragging their feet on authentication on it before they handed over $1.5 million to him. So they're dragging their feet on authenticating it. Mark had counted on that going through. He had racked up a bunch of debt and was figuring the Oath of a Freeman would sell. He would have all kind of buku bucks to pay off his debts and have money to live on and that. Well, it got stalled. So now he's got a problem with all his creditors. And so he had tried to tell the church he had the McClellan collection. And this would be worth a lot of money. Hey, guys, I got the McClellan collection. And it's got all kind of early Mormon documents. When he left the church, he took a bunch of documents with him. And I'm on the verge to buy all this in Texas. There was all kind of rumors going around at the time about these McClellan papers in Texas. And so Mark was going to get these. And then he started saying, well, it even has a part of the papyri in it. And he started talking about all this different stuff that was in this collection. He doesn't have this collection to give to the church. He has had to come up with a story of this collection to try to do something to get money to tide him over till that Oath of a Freeman sells. And so in order to get enough money, he's got to make the collection big enough to make it worth some money. But he can't show it literally to anyone. He could show a few pieces from it. And so his hope is to get the church to buy it sight unseen and him promise he'll put it away for him.
Wow.
And so he can't have anyone that knows anything to really look at what he has. Steve Christensen this time had worked with Mark and the different people studying church history to the point that he knew enough at this point of church history that he would have known it didn't meet what Mark said. Mark had even got on consignment a piece of papyri from New York that looked similar to the Joseph Smith papyri from the right time period and all to be a proof that he had this big collection and it had part of the Joseph Smith papyri in it. But he didn't have enough stuff. One of the things he said was in the collection was the McClellan diaries. And that it was supposed to have all kind of damaging stuff into it. So the church says, well, okay, maybe we'll do business with you to buy that from you, but we want Steve Christensen to look at the collection to, because we trust Steve. We want Steve to look at the collection and say it's really what you say. Well, Mark can't have Steve look at the documents. Steve will know it isn't what he said. It isn't enough. There's just few things there. It isn't what he's really been selling it as. So he can't have Steve look at it. What's the solution? Well, we'll just go plant a bomb full of nails outside his office and kill the guy. So, because Mark thinks that then he can get the church to quickly do a deal with him. You know, hey, people are trying to stop this transaction. You guys got to buy it quick so we can get it put away. Like us anti-Mormons are out there running around killing people or something, you know. I don't know what's in mind, but anyway, so he kills Steve off. Well, then you got to have something to cover that up that it's not connected to his documents.
Got it.
So then you put a bomb in Christensen's driveway. No one has to die at Christensen's. He just needs a bomb to connect Christensen with Steve, so it's a business deal gone sour.
Not Christensen, but
not Sheets. Mr. Sheets had done business with Christensen. And so he puts this bomb in front of the Sheets driveway. Well, Mr. Sheets, I think he'd already left. The wife went out jogging every morning. She goes out jogging, doesn't see the box in front of the garage till she comes back home from her jog. She sees the box there. She reaches down to pick it up to take it in the house. And as soon as she picks it up, it blows her to smithereens. And his bombs were very cruel in that they were full of nails. The point of the bomb was to shred you. You will not live through this. And that's Steve Christensen's. It was packed with nails, shredded the guy's insides. I mean, he was dead instantly.
Did you and Gerald have any idea that Hoffman was behind the bombs?
We knew that as soon as that happened, it had to be Mark.
As soon as the bombs went off, you knew it was Mark?
Yeah. Who else would do it?
So were you scared for your own?
Oh, yeah. Big scared. I called up when the second bomb went off. It was when Mark's bomb went off. So then
Mark, that's right. Mark was, where was he taking his third bomb?
It was at a car, there used to be the LDS gym up where the church has their conference center now, up on the hill there. And he parked his car on the other side of the gym, walked down to the mall that was there, that's now whatever.
ZCMI Mall.
No, yeah, the old ZCMI Mall. No, it wasn't ZCMI, it was the one across the street.
Okay.
And directly south of Temple Square. So Mark walks down two blocks to come into that mall. And he, every Wednesday, I think it was, he always met Brent Ashworth from Provo, document collector. He met him every Wednesday at the Borders bookstore or something, whatever the bookstore was in the mall. They used to meet there on Wednesdays and talk about rare books and transactions and who has what documents and stuff. And the document guy from Provo had bought a lot of stuff from Mark, and Mark owed him money because of trading and different documents and stuff. And so he would have been pressing Mark for money as well. Brent Ashworth, when the two bombs happen, he decides not to go to his Wednesday appointment. He's worried. He doesn't know what's going on. Does this have to do with document dealers? He's not sure, so he opts to not come to Salt Lake that day. Mark goes to the mall not knowing that, and we know he went to the mall because in his belongings they found a receipt for the New York Times or something, and so they knew he'd been to that bookstore and evidently saw that Ashworth didn't show up. Well, now he has a mercury-switched bomb in the front seat of his car that he's got to do something with. My conclusion was that was meant for Brent Ashworth, that he was going to tell Brent, I've got a new document for you. Man, is this going to be good? Here's the keys to my car. You go look at it. I've got something I got to do at the church office building or wherever, and I'll meet you there in a few minutes, and you decide if you want it or something, you know. I'm assuming that he was going to send Ashworth to his car to look at it, and that he would have picked up the bomb and been blown up, and then Mark could have said, see, there's somebody after us.
And then that would make people think that Mark was actually one of the targets.
Yeah.
And then they wouldn't suspect him as a...
Right. Okay. So, but Brent doesn't show up. So now what do? You got a live bomb sitting in your car. Well, he goes up to his car.
And he had already set it.
Yeah, well, he doesn't have... Yeah, he's done. It's the mercury switch. You know, you have to keep it absolutely level. And I went to the whole preliminary hearing. It lasted for a whole month. It was fascinating. So I heard all the testimony. People at the bus stop up at the top of the hill said they saw Mark come out to his car. He went into the trunk and was ruffling through stuff in the trunk, slammed the thing down. I think that was to see how sensitive the bomb was. And nothing went off. And so he's fiddling with the doors and stuff, and it doesn't go off. So I think he's thinking, well, it's not as sensitive as I thought. So he gets in the driver's seat, puts his right knee on the seat, his other leg is outside of the car, and he reaches over to pick that box up. And as soon as he gets it above the center console, he can't keep it straight. Maybe he bumped his arm on the steering wheel or something. We don't know what happened. But it goes off, and it blows him out of the car and blows off his kneecap and a couple of his fingers.
But it doesn't blow him to bits.
No. And see, that's how the police knew that he was responsible, was because he told a different story at the hospital, that he sat down in the car and picked up the box. And so the police immediately knew he was lying to them, that it must be him, because it would have killed him if he had sat in the car. He would not have been thrown out. The door had to be open. He had to have one leg already out. He had to be reaching in. Or the forensic guy was really interesting because they mapped every shred back on these strings to show you where they knew exactly where the bomb was, how far above the console, everything when it went off. And they knew from his injuries, he had to be halfway out of the car, and that blew him out. So he has to be knowing that the bomb's dangerous, so he has to be the guilty party. And so then we became news in that when all the reporters came to do the story on the whole thing, they'd go talk to the police about what's the deal in all of this. And we'd already been putting out little flyers of our take on the whole deal, that, you know, hey, this shows Mark's a con guy. And the police would just tell them, why don't you go down and talk to the Tanners? We can't tell you anything about our research, but talk to the Tanners. So we had all kind of reporters coming to us, ended up 3 major paperback books done on the Hoffman story, and we feature in all, well, not feature, but we're mentioned in all of them about this whole doubting his documents and everything. We had so many people come to us after that, after they read those different paperbacks, that said, I never trusted you before, but it suddenly dawned on me, you were the only guys that were saying there was something wrong with Mark Hoffman's documents. I've got pictures in the Deseret News where Hoffman's meeting with Tanner and Kimball. Who else was in the picture?
But
Hinckley, the first presidency. All looking at his documents, you know, and they don't get a clue that it's a fraud. How can Gerald do this, you know? So that won us credibility that we'd never had before, that people said, wow, you know, we got to pay more attention to what these guys are saying. They're the ones that seem to be on to the story. Gerald and I both were on different national TV shows on the Mark, being interviewed on the Mark Hoffman case. So it was a really big change in perception in the, much of the community when that happened.
So that was maybe your biggest break of all.
Yeah, in 85. Yeah, that really was a game changer in getting some credibility that maybe we have something to say.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories Podcast. To check out the video version of this episode, go to youtube.com/Mormon Stories. To continue the conversation or to keep these podcasts alive through a financial contribution, please check us out at mormonstories.org, and thanks for listening.
Come, come, ye saints, no toil nor labor fear, but with joy wend your way. Though hard to you this journey may appear, grace shall be as your day. Tis better far to drive, do this and joy. Your hearts will swell. Oh, all is well. All is well.